I'm about to move the mic again. Thank you. And thanks for that reading, Isabella. Also, I'm very happy that I predicted your height correctly. Now, last time I preached, we talked about the fact that we are now living in a low-context society. Due to the wealth and variety of modern life, we no longer share very many experiences with one another. And as a result, communication is much more difficult than it used to be. When there were only three channels on TV, you could be pretty sure that everyone watched Johnny Carson or MASH. Now, there's millions of YouTubers and thousands of TikTokers and hundreds of TV channels. We all get to choose now what we consume from life, and this means that we share very little things in common. Practically, this means that communication now is almost always cross-cultural. Therefore, we have to find and actively find ways to connect with our neighbors. It is not as inherent as living next to one another would suggest. As we've talked about, the only way to connect is by actually caring about our neighbors as people and as individuals. Our low-context society is full of salesmen, scammers, and advertisements. And as a result, there are plenty of reasons to be wary of strangers. I don't know the last time you had a positive, life-changing encounter with a random stranger on the street, but I'm willing to bet that that's a very rare experience. As a result, from an outsider's perspective, there are not a lot of inherent reasons to trust that any church or any Christian has something valuable to say, let alone something valuable enough to transform the entirety of your life for. The only way to sufficiently differentiate ourselves from a world of salesmen is to demonstrate enough trustworthiness and care over a sufficient length of time for our words to matter. In a low-context environment like ours, it is often necessary to show rather than to tell. Therefore, evangelism based on anything other than the love which God has granted to us is intrinsically hollow. In the same way that God invited us into his own life and into the life of his people, so too are we to make that same offer to our neighbors. That is at its core what evangelism is. If we belong to the life of God, then we share that with our neighbors. It is one of the few practical ways to build trust. And after all, we're not offering a hobby or a sale or cheap childcare for a couple of hours. It is the very nature of the church to demonstrate the life of God. Nevertheless, at some point, it will become necessary for us to explain ourselves. We can show people that the life of the church is different and that being Christian changes you. But at some point, we will need to explain why and how this is possible. But here, too, communication is complicated, not only at the level of a lack of shared experiences and context, but at the level of language itself. Like the Tower of Babel, our speech is now scattered so that we are no longer able to effectively communicate with one another. Insofar as language itself is a part of culture and context, we are now separated by a common language. Now, the Tower of Babel is about many things, as we've discussed in Teen Sunday School. For example, its location east of Eden is representative of a move away from God. And when they build a tower, they are really building a ziggurat, a Mesopotamian temple structure, and not a European-style watchtower. The context of Genesis suggests that the early humans are trying to build a replacement for Eden after they've been exiled out of the garden. They want to dwell with God, and so the early humans try to build a tower to physically reach heaven in order to meet him there. But for our purposes, I want to focus only on two aspects of the Babel story. First is what happens when we refuse to listen, and the second is on the nature of language itself. One of the main points the story of Babel is addressing is God's command to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the whole earth, which is in Genesis 1, 26 to 28. At this point in God's story in Genesis 11, Adam and Eve may have sinned, but God's design for the world persists. Humans are still supposed to spread out, they're still supposed to multiply, and they're still supposed to fill the whole earth. In this sense, to be exiled from the garden is at once a punishment and an extension of God's plan. A punishment because they no longer have direct access to God, but an extension because God's plan was always to fill the whole earth with his images. Now, life in the garden was certainly easier, but life in the garden was not always supposed to stay in the garden. Adam and Eve were always meant to expand. It is in this context that the Babylonite decision to stay put and to build with bricks is a problem. God did not ask them to build a new temple for him. God did not ask them to make a substitute for Eden. And so God comes down to scatter them. You may wonder, why? Didn't God make us for community? As it says in Genesis 1, it is not good for man to be alone. And don't the later Israelites build a temple for God himself? Why is it okay later, but a problem now? God's purposes may be timeless, but sometimes timing is everything. Doing the quote-unquote right thing at the wrong time is still doing the wrong thing. It's like cleaning your room so that you can get out of having to help with dinner and the dishes. You weren't supposed to pick and choose one chore or the other. You were supposed to do both. Doing one chore to avoid the other is still a problem. In the same way, the Babylonites are trying to do the quote-unquote right thing to avoid the thing that God has actually asked them to do. God asked them to spread out and to fill the whole earth, not to stay put and rebuild Eden. God knew that there is no simple way to go back, that the exile is going to last a long time. Sin has infected the world, and you are not going to build your way out of it. The early humans want to skip steps in order to return to life with God, but that process is not possible. Our situation is not exactly like Babel. I do not think we are living in open defiance of God. I do nevertheless think there are parallels between the Babel story and our own. Specifically, as we think about evangelism, we should be very careful about what we are building as a church, as a people, and as an institution. We should only build what God has actually asked us to build. And we should not look for shortcuts back to Eden. We should not do things which look superficially like the right thing to do in order to avoid doing the thing that God has actually asked us to do. For a lot of churches, and Chinese churches specifically, evangelism has historically meant getting people to come to Sunday service and to participate in quote-unquote church activities. And this makes a certain amount of sense. Our church is the way it is because we like it well enough. And I'm not saying that we should stop all church activities. All I'm saying is that we must recognize that Eden cannot be rebuilt here. Like someone procrastinating one chore by doing another, getting people to come to church services has often been a means of trying to bypass the hard work of relationship building and bypassing our own need to be spiritually healthy. It is not that going to church services or church activities is wrong. It is that it is not primarily what God has asked us to do. Going to church is supposed to help us to love our neighbor. It is not a replacement for loving our neighbor. And this brings us to the nature of language. If we want to build relationships and to love our neighbors well, we need to be able to effectively communicate with them. Here, our situation is remarkably like that at the time of Babel, though this may not be immediately obvious to us. After all, Babel is famously a story about the division of languages. We all primarily speak English, and a lot of us are bilingual besides, So at the surface level, we all speak mostly the same language. But shared words are no guarantee of shared meaning. Specifically, within our context, a lot of church language is a dialect that I like to think of as Christianese. These are words which basically only Christians use and which have no real meaning in the outside world. For example, words like grace, holy, and sacred are basically never used by secular people. Outside of video games and anime, I don't know if I've ever heard such language being used in normal, everyday speech. Insofar as we wish to speak to non-believers and people who didn't grow up in a church context, we have to define our terms or else skip them altogether. The big word in Christianese, for example, is faith. In modern English, faith means something like belief in the abstract and unknowable, often without evidence. That is not at all how the Bible talks about faith. In Greek, pistis, or Hebrew, emunah, these conceptually are a lot more like what we would call trust rather than what modern English calls faith. As an illustration, imagine you're at Niagara Falls, and there happens to be a tightrope walker who's set up to walk across the falls. I know that's illegal, but just ignore that for the moment. You watch them go back and forth several times, and she does it perfectly every time. First, she goes off with one of those big balancing sticks, and then with no stick, and then a wheelbarrow filled with bricks. You see them do this several times, and she makes it across every time, and it's easy. She then offers anyone who wants a chance to ride across in the wheelbarrow. You see one person do it, and then a second person do it, and then a third person do it. Super easy, no problems, makes it across every time. It's your turn next. Do you get in the wheelbarrow? Faith, in the biblical context, is getting in the wheelbarrow. Trust is making your way across the tightrope. Trusting in the tightrope walker is not a matter of blind belief. You have already seen plenty of evidence that she is very capable. You've seen her do it before. When the Bible talks about faith, this is the kind of thing that the Bible is talking about. To believe in Jesus is not to hold some kind of abstraction in your mind. It is to live as though Jesus is trustworthy. After all, Christianity is built on the testimony of the eyewitnesses. Our spiritual ancestors experienced God and reported on their experiences. And it is on this basis that we trust in Jesus. Whether it's our ancestors in the Bible or whether it's the people that brought you to faith, somebody else trusted in Jesus first and told you about it, and it is on that basis that we ourselves trust. We can, of course, debate whether this testimony is reliable. Should we trust eyewitness accounts? But my overall point is this. That testimony exists. That evidence exists. Our logic, our experience of God exists. Our trust in God is not the same as faith as it is often defined in the modern world. Our trust in God overall should not be without evidence. As another example of Christianese, grace is an important theological concept which in the secular world basically only has athletic overtones now. We talk about gymnasts and divers being graceful. We rarely talk about grace as the mercy of God, as the undeserved favor, as God gifting us good things even though we don't deserve it. God is gracious to us because of who he is by nature and not because of who we are. Grace is by definition undeserved. And so when we talk about the grace of God, when we sing things like Amazing Grace, we are talking about the nature and character of God himself, and not about, say, Jesus' high-diving ability. I'm sure if you make it to heaven, you can ask him to see if he can do it or not. We can keep going with all sorts of examples of Christianese. Holiness means separate, not pretension. A temple is a place where God dwells in person, not a fancy building where worship services are held. A church is primarily a people and not a building. And so on and so forth. All of this is to say that the default way in which we talk, especially as Christians who grew up in the church, is often more or less unintelligible to the outside world. Think of the last time you heard of the word fellowship that didn't relate to the Fellowship of the Ring. Unless you're in high academia and you're going on your postdoctoral fellowship, this is basically never used in any part of life. Sometimes, the way we talk as Christians is even unintelligible to other Christians. There are many denominations, and they do not all mean the same things when we talk about core theological concepts. For example, communion. At CLBC specifically, I know with certainty that as a church, we are not always on the same page about the meaning of things like worship, evangelism, and even what it means to be a church together. Let me be clear, though. I'm not saying that dedicated theological language is always a bad thing. As long as we can create mutual understanding, that understanding is all that matters. In the same way that there is a limit on how much you can simplify a car before it is no longer a car, you cannot always simplify language. There are theological concepts which cannot be adequately translated and must simply be learned. For example, the doctrine of the Trinity. There is a minimum amount of knowledge necessary to become a Christian, and it will be up to us to explain that minimum amount of knowledge. At the same time, though, we should not make understanding Christianity artificially hard for people if we can help it. That means, practically, that we should use less Christianese and preferably to not use it at all. After all, Christianese can also be used to hide our own spiritual unhealthiness. If we cannot explain what our core concepts are in plain English, it is very likely that we don't actually understand them. At the same time that we need to learn to speak more plainly, though, we must also learn to listen more carefully. The only way to tell if our neighbors understand us is to talk to them and to listen to them. After all, we are not the only ones with a unique religious dialect. If you spend enough time with any group of people, you will find that they also have unique ways of speaking and thinking about the world. If you watch old TV or movies, you might hear a cook 86-something at the old diner. In modern English, a lot of African-American vernacular English becomes cool over time. Specifically, the word cool to mean something awesome rather than something physically cold comes from the 1930s black jazz scene. More specifically for us, because we live in a place which is a mixture of religions and beliefs, there are a multitude of frameworks for understanding what belief even means in the first place. Christian ideas may or may not have any meaning at all within the linguistic and cultural frameworks of these other religions and beliefs. For example, sin only has meaning if you believe there is an objective moral framework, which Christians would call God's design. It is because God designed the world to operate in certain ways that it is possible to break that design, and so sin against God. If God did not design the world, then there is no meaningful possibility of sin in a Christian sense. If a different God or set of gods made the world, then what those gods designed would be the basis of morality. Practically speaking, then, for evangelism to work, you have to listen well enough to find out where there are actual points of similarity and understanding. Telling someone who fundamentally does not understand the concept of sin that Jesus died to forgive them is basically a meaningless statement to them. You first have to get on the same page about whether or not the idea of God is possible, what that God or gods is like, and whether or not to participate in God's design. The sheer variety of beliefs in the modern world means there is no functional way to go over every possible leaf that people have now from the pulpit. At the same time, though, one core Christian doctrine is that because we are all made in the image of God, we are all in some sense searching for the relationships which God has designed us for. As a result, there will always be points of commonality between our religious dialect and those of our neighbors. Here are some broad examples. If a person still believes in philosophical modernity and in the idea that human technology will save us, it is probably not going to change their beliefs to have Christians just to be nice to them. It's the wrong core problem to address. They need evidence that their position is wrong and that human technology and science are fundamentally limited. Sometimes people ask why God would allow so much evil in the world, and that's a very valid question to ask. But that same charge can be leveled against all of humanity. Why do we allow so much evil and suffering in the world? Why do we create weapons of increasingly mass destruction and then use them? Can human ingenuity really solve any problem when there is so much evidence to the contrary? Why are we so comfortable oppressing the poor? God's willingness to allow evil may be an abstract problem. Human willingness to allow evil is a problem that we all see every day. To be sure, I am not suggesting that this kind of conversation will immediately convert someone to Christianity. I am saying that this kind of groundwork is necessary to even begin talking about Jesus in the first place. I think it is empirically true that human progress is not inherently good. I think there's so much evidence that human progress has caused immense suffering. And at the same time, I think it's true that Christian theology has one explanation of why this is the case: the problem of sin, the fall, and the curse. But here, I think, is one of the places where everyone can agree. We can see the suffering in the world, and we all look for a reason to explain it or to understand it. In contrast, a person who is more pre-modern may not need that same kind of evidence. It may not be as fruitful to have that kind of discussion with them. A lot of people can be convinced to become Christian simply in order to belong to a tribe. Humans are inherently social creatures, and social pressure can be incredibly powerful, for better and for worse. Insofar as I understand the history of Chinese Christianity in Canada, this was the dominant strategy in the early days of immigration, and remains the dominant strategy to a large degree. Whether this ought to be our dominant strategy is up for debate, but some people will do anything it takes to belong to a group, for better and for worse. For these people, a conversation about the nature of evil is probably not as important as the willingness to sit, to talk, and to welcome. And this too makes sense to us as Christians. We fully believe that it is not good for man to be alone. And for the postmodern person, for whom institutions are inherently untrustworthy, evangelism programs which are based in the church building are unlikely to be attractive. The problem for postmoderns, who have seen how corrupt institutions can be, is not that our beliefs are right or wrong, it is that we are often extremely hypocritical about them. By way of analogy, it's a lot easier to trust a gym trainer who's fit than one who's not. At a technical level, we all understand that they may be equally proficient. There's no reason an unfit person can't have a degree in sports science or an unfit person can't be a doctor. But it's just easier to trust the fit person because their life matches the message. It has nothing to do with the technical prowess. It has everything to do whether the hypocrisy is visible or not. For the postmodern skeptic, what is necessary is evidence that the Christian life can actually and truly be lived, and lived well. Of course, these are not the only objections people have to Christianity, and these are not the only points of contact between the Christian story and the stories of the world. We cannot go through all of them, but I can promise that if you listen well enough, you will find points of connection. God has made us for a relationship with Him, with each other, and with the world. And so everyone, literally everyone, is searching for these things in some manner or other. Whether it's the social justice activist searching for something like justice, some way of dealing with evil in the world, whether it's the lonely person searching for community, or whether it's the astrology reading California Valley girl looking up her horoscope to see if the universe cares. There are points of connection between our story and the stories of the world. We are all searching for the same things, and if we speak kindly and plainly, and if we listen carefully and well, we will be able to connect ourselves to the stories of our neighbors and to the story of God. Amen.